Hello and welcome to the podcast of ideas. My name is Ella Whelan, and as you can hear, I've lost my voice a little bit, but we're back this week with another Academy of Ideas team discussion because there is a lot happening, and there has been a lot happening in relation to anti-Semitism, the question around what's happening in Israel and Gaza, and some pretty unedifying performances in Parliament. So we want to get into all of that. Joining me this week, as ever, is Academy of Ideas team, Claire Fox, Alistair Donald, Jeff Kidder, and we're also very excited to be joined by Mark Burbeck from Our Fight, who's in the office with us. So welcome, Mark. So let's just start by with the immediate news this week of what's been happening in the House of the Parliament. I won't go into the details of it because it's so sort of complicated and facile in many ways. But there's essentially been a row about procedure over amendments in relation to the calls for a ceasefire, various flavours of a calls for ceasefire from the SNP, from the Labour Party. And the Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, has got into trouble for allowing a Labour amendment to be discussed. And this broke with procedure. But more importantly, what happened was 24 hours of parliamentary infighting about who was allowed to speak and whether the speaker had been prejudiced and who'd last spoken in the speaker's ear, with all the while events taking place in Israel and Gaza that had no interest and nothing to do with the shenanigans in the British Parliament. But it certainly showed some of the egos in Parliament, and it certainly showed some of the priorities for parliamentarians. One of them, a Tory MP, being quoted as saying, "We are not here to essentially deal with potholes. We're here to save lives." So you got a real sense of the grandeur in which some parliamentarians hold themselves in. So Claire, you have obviously spent the week in Parliament in the other house, in the House of Lords, and been party to some of these discussions. What have you made of all of this?
I think that on the one hand, we might have looked on in dismay at the fact that Parliament became embroiled in an argument about which version of a ceasefire amendment was going to be the most palatable, with the SNP, the Labour Party, and the Tories competing. And in one speech, somebody said, is it a pause? Is it a humanitarian ceasefire? Is it a temporary? Is it a permanent? Is it, by the time you've finished, right, you can't even work out the distinctions between them. And that discussion would never have saved a life or made any difference to what was happening in the region. So on the one hand, the superficiality and performative nature of it felt utterly surreal in the build-up to the discussion. What subsequently has occurred is actually much more serious than anything that's happened in Parliament for a very long time, which is, one way or another, it was a decision was made to change parliamentary procedure, which is not just a joke to be dismissed, which was a vote that was, a day that was given over to the SNP to have an amendment, was completely distorted by the decision of Lindsay Hoyle, as everyone knows now. And the argument that he's used is not that he was doing the Labour Party a favour, but that actually he did it to protect the lives of parliamentarians who were under threat, or, to protect the safety of parliamentarians. And all that you can say is, if we were to conclude that parliamentary business and what way people voted in the House of Commons was entirely dependent and circumspect on whether they were, who was the most frightening bogeyman, then obviously democracy's done in. I mean, you might as well just dispense with voting. You just say, who's the strong-armed, which person has got the strongest, most threatening, who can threaten the most violence, and then you can win a vote, right? So that's obviously disastrous. And I think that it's driving me mad that people don't understand that that's the key issue here. It's not whether who said what to who, but the fact that that is publicly on record as being the reason why this kerfuffle occurred. And I think that people are underestimating what this represents. But I've been glad that people like Geoffrey Cox has got it. Some of the speeches in the Commons yesterday are worth looking at, because there were some fantastic speeches that understood this absolutely. in terms of the significance of it. But there's also people who are in complete denial and just saying, oh no, this is all to do with inter-party squabbles between the SNP, the Labour Party, and it's who's acted most disgracefully. On Newsnight last night, there was somebody arguing that this was a whole Tory setup to discredit Keir Starmer. You know, a completely self-obsessed, narcissistic way of dealing with it. The only other thing I say to hear other people is that in the midst of all of this discussion, there was no regard paid whatsoever to the potential nuances of what they were calling for in terms of ceasefire. It was just politics done as the most emotive nod to various different constituencies. It was done in a way that would really discredit a serious government considering foreign policy decisions. And I don't care which side you're on, that wasn't the spirit in which this debate happened. People were queuing up in order to be seen by their constituents to be on the right side of history. It was disgraceful and distasteful.
Mark, let's have your views. Just for anyone who doesn't know about Our Fight, it's a campaigning organisation that was set up in response to the attacks and pogroms of the 7th of October, and is primarily non-Jews standing in solidarity with Jews. Mark, you told us about the fact that you went to vigils and was astounded by the how few non-Jewish people were there standing in solidarity with Jews. So Our Fight checked them out. Mark, what have you made of this week in Parliament?
As Claire says, yeah, it's chaos. It just shows you the when everybody thought they'd put anti-Semitism to bed, the issue rears its ugly head in so many different forms. We can see the problems that universities are having up and down the country. The problems, in particular, we're talking here about the political parties being unable to really clarify where they stand. So Claire's right that, we had many different versions of the ceasefire, and it did seem to turn on some of the nuances there. But and it did seem that there wasn't much to choose between them. But I think one of the key things that you can see in their different positions was where they stand on criticizing Israel. So the SNP, their motion, which didn't get discussed, was on the idea of collective punishment. So this was something that the Labour Party felt they couldn't support, even though the Labour Party now have moved on the idea of a ceasefire. They felt that they couldn't support this idea of collective punishment that was being put forward by the SNP. They, on the other hand, were saying that there should be aid going in, that Rafah, that there should be no move on Rafah. So that's their position. They feel that they're entitled to tell Israel how to fight this war. And then the Tories, the other kind of end of the spectrum, even though that, like you say, they're all talking about ceasefire, they're talking about there must be a two-state solution, the hostages must be released. So they are. So you can see what everybody's trying to do is they're trying to sort of play to all the different audiences at the same time. Everybody's trying to say ceasefire so that they can play to the radicals and the progressives, but then they're also trying to have the kind of more grown-up position. Like I think the Tories are trying to be a little bit more grown up and say, well, look, you know, the hostages do need to be released. There does need to be a long-term solution, not like a humanitarian ceasefire, but there needs to be a long-term solution. So they're talking about the two-state solution. But the whole thing is just a mess. And then, as you say, Claire, the final piece of the jigsaw is that in order to save the faces of the different parties, so the Labour Party, if their motion hadn't been discussed, then their people would have been faced with the choice of voting for the SNP, which was much more critical of Israel, or voting for the Tory amendment, which was obviously much more supportive of Israel. So they manoeuvred in order to get their own motion, as you rightly point out, to be discussed, their own amendment to be discussed. And then, of course, Hoyle then tries to justify this with all of the points you make about saying this is about safety. And maybe we can go into this a bit more and, you know, let other people speak, but there's got to be something said here as well about whether they're talking up this threat, you know, whether people like Freya are obviously understandably concerned, but whether they're actually talking up this threat and they're creating an even greater distance between Parliament and ordinary people. And ultimately, they're not prepared to have these discussions. They're putting out notions of ceasefire. They've got these different positions on where they stand on Israel, but they're not really prepared to go and have these debates with people and discuss, and try and win people around.
As Claire says, the overturning of procedure is a particularly important thing and should definitely not be taken lightly. On the other hand, I think that the people have rightly said the SNP only get 3 days a year to put forward their own motion, and it is not right that they're elbowed out of the way. At the same time, they acted entirely cynically in terms of the motion that they've put forward. I mean, they have all sorts of things that they could have presented on this important day in Parliament, and they went for a cynical manoeuvre that was really much more about them trying to make a point about themselves rather than allowing any useful debate about the situation in Israel. Which, let's I think it's right that Parliament should debate these things, but not in the way that it's been done. Likewise, the Labour Party has used the motion quite cynically for its own purposes, rather than to have a needed debate within Parliament. So I think the divorce between what these political parties want to do in terms of taking care of their own concerns versus the real world issues, I think that divide has steadily grown, and it's a real problem just now. On the threat to the MPs, I mean, obviously there is a context on this in terms, as Mark's mentioned, of attacks on MPs in the last few years, whether it's Jo Cox or David Amos, and so on and so forth. So there is, to some extent, a genuine threat there. I think, though, that the one of the things, even with David Amos, where the Islamist motive was very much a part of that, but even in the discussion of the aftermath of that brutal murder, a lot of the discussion was very it shifted the discussion from something specific, as in the Islamist motive, into a much more general, oh well, the social media out there is nasty, and all these MPs are facing people who voice their concerns in quite a nasty way. So it strips out of that discussion the thing that's actually very important. And the striking thing to me was the way it ends up almost like a health and safety discussion around MPs, rather than a threat to democracy by people who do not want the discussion to be had. And I think that's a problem as well. We need to recognize that the challenge just now is political and one to democracy rather than one, a kind of narrow-based one of health and safety.
Well, it was really interesting listening to Yvette Cooper on the Today programme this morning, responding to comments from Suella Braverman about an Islamist threat to democracy. And the Labour Party is very bad at labeling what these threats are that are being put up against their MPs, and everybody knows that it is the tone of it is kind of an Islamist. It sort of fits into that kind of category. And Suella Braverman came out and said this is a big problem. Yvette Cooper was asked, well, isn't she right? She said, absolutely not, it's disgraceful, did the usual Suella Braverman doesn't know what she's talking about, blah 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 thing. And it's just quite astounding that Cooper is essentially, seems to me, gaslighting her own MPs, who are coming to her and saying, look, there's a bit of a problem here, whether it's Wes Streeting being quite aggressively doorstopped in Ilford or wherever else. And Mike Freer narrowly escaped Ali Harbour Ali's attacks. He was the person that Ali was going to attack before. He just set his sights on David Amos. So, it seems to me quite outrageous, actually, the Labour Party is so cowardly in its desire to not even go near any prospect of it being Islamophobic, then it won't label the threats to its MP at the moment as Islamist. It's a very sort of bad situation. But Jeff, what have you made of all of this?
I do think we should emphasize, as Claire did at the beginning, that it is a people are talking about inter-party squabbling and all these people doing all these things, and it's all a bit not quite be able to make out what's going on. But I do think it's a significant week in Parliament overall. And I do think I think Claire explained what it represents quite well. And I think the fact that, and I was there in Parliament for a time on Wednesday, and you got that sense that grave is too strong a word, but you got that sense that, you know, there were important things going on. It's very serious and significant, even though it might have taken this rather peculiar form. So I think you want to say that. I think on the, you know, the issue of threats, obviously you want people to be robust. You want people to push back and carry on doing what they want to do and not give in. But there obviously is a problem, as has been described already, whether you call it the debasing of politics or social life or whatever, that people are feeling and are subject to various threats that weren't the case in the same way before for a long time. And that is of note in relation to what's happening, and obviously affected what the shenanigans and what went on in Parliament. But it's obviously important things. And as Ella has just said, there are politicians and some journalists, particularly Labour politicians, but not necessarily, but not solely Labour politicians, who react when anybody says there's an Islamist problem or there's a, you know, a problem with violence. They say, "Oh no, no, you're exaggerating it." And they basically want to close down debate on it. And the reaction to Suella Braverman, you don't necessarily need to agree with her, with the way she's phrased it, but it's like, oh, we shouldn't be saying these things. This will make everything worse, rather than having an honest discussion about what's going on, which is what is necessary. The other point, the final point I would say is in relation to the potholes in lives, watching part of the debate from the balcony as I did the other day, it was just a succession of people who were talking very passionately as if they were all MPs for a different region of Gaza, and very forcefully, and you know, very much believed in the terrible events that were going on. And it just seems to be the case that it's good that people are concerned about events, you know, and serious events happening around the world. But at the end of the day, those people are members of parliament for various constituencies in Britain. And there's a sense that some have certainly lost sight of their primary role and have become very attached to Gaza, which seems to be what the sort of go-to thing to talk about just at the moment. And I think that is of concern. And that obviously then feeds down to quite a lot of constituents who also have that state of mind. And that's also concerning.
Well, it's interesting what all of this means for people who are constituents, you know, ordinary people outside the Houses of Parliament, because there has been an incredible rise of anti-Semitism, as we all know. We've mentioned in previous podcasts, but just to kind of put it into figures, the Community Security Trust released a report about a week ago, which showed that self-reported incidents of anti-Semitism, hate crime, that's what they called it, had, you know, risen to numbers above 4,000. Much of that wasn't just sort of speech things that you might quibble over, but serious violence, assault, attacks. We all can pull up various examples of, you know, people being accosted in the street, people having stuff shouted at them, all the rest of it. And that's something that has markedly risen since the 7th of October. And there are many people thinking, well, how should we respond to this? This is a terrible thing. What's the solution? And Claire, it's kind of depressing that, if not unsurprising, that in Parliament, the solution that seems to be being put forward by MPs is either to increase, you know, hate crime legislation, increase reporting of non-hate crime incidents or whatever they're called, suggestions that you've been talking about in the House of Lords this week, of banning public bodies from being able to use their investments for BDS, so basically banning people from supporting BDS in various instances. And now news out this morning, in response to sort of fears from MPs about protests outside their houses, that there might be buffer zones instituted outside constituency offices or people's homes. So quite, and you know, for people who are interested in free speech, this is a problem. It's a very illiberal response to a, you know, illiberal outburst of anti-Semitism. How do we square that circle?
So one of the things that's should be noted, and it's very difficult to explain, particularly to younger listeners and young people is that anti-Semitism and Jew hatred historically is associated with a degeneration of civilizational values. It's very hard to get that over, right? It's not just like people are attacking Jewish people. It's got a broader resonance. And that's something which, you know, people who've understood or studied the period in Nazi Germany and not just done it at GCSE, but have done it in some detail, will know about, right? That there's something more going on. So I say that because one of the most depressing aspects of this whole discussion is that we get the rise of anti-Jewish hatred, and the only thing that anyone in Parliament can think about is to bring in authoritarian rules to ban it, which completely misses the point for a starter. The other thing is, and this is something which we haven't got time to go into now, nobody can talk about anti-Semitism. I'm just talking about in Parliament. Nobody mentions anti-Semitism in Parliament without talking about and the rise of Islamophobia. I mean, it's like a sort of dual act. You have to do it, right? So they just sort of, so then it becomes hate in general, and then it becomes, we need laws. We need to ban people from demonstrating outside Parliament. And I don't care what anyone says. The points I made at the beginning about the really serious nature of subverting the democratic process through threats of violence were not embodied by a group of people standing outside Parliament having a protest on Wednesday, right? They weren't the threat. But we do know that there has been a real resistance to taking on Islamism over the last decade, right? People in politics don't want to do it. Already today, I have seen people saying that the intervention of various Tories on this issue has made it worse for Muslims in this country. So they're saying, by saying it's Lindsay Hoyle's statement now means that Muslims are going to be attacked. Now, I don't want to be unsympathetic to Muslims, but my God, the problem we face is the rise of an Islamist atmosphere that nobody will challenge. And that is frightening. And we know that the police are really reluctant to take it on. The threat of violence is there in relation to Islamism. We only have to think of ISIS. We only have to think of the bombings on the tube and the points that Ella made. But I think people are just missing the point. It's not just that you feel physically unsafe. It's that there is an atmosphere of intimidation rather than argument, that you basically know that if you go and vote the wrong way, that there's almost like a block group of people, and I don't just mean Muslims, I mean people who are on one side of this Gaza war, will basically make your life hell. And that's the point in that interview with Angela Rayner that she made, which is that you're just like followed around constantly, people shouting at you. It's a very difficult point, this, because I want people to have the freedom in this country to shout at their MPs. You know what I mean? I don't want them to be surrounded by buffer zones so that the public can't get anywhere near. I think Mark made a great point in the beginning. You want our elected politicians to have the courage to go out and argue with people about why they are, for example, supporting Israel or not going for an immediate ceasefire, or why they think the hostages matter, or why there's a problem with anti-Jewish hatred, not hiding away behind the law and a buffer zone. But it would be wrong to say that there is no atmosphere of menacing dread. And I don't just mean for Jewish people, but for Jewish people, that absolutely exists. And Jess Phillips just put a tweet out where she said, I left Parliament the other night and I was on the tube with some people who'd been on the demonstrations, and they were lovely and they were all chatty and friendly. I don't know what the fuss is about. And you just think, what country are you living in? And I don't mean that those protesters weren't lovely, and that's what I'm saying, right? I want to win them round to my way of looking at things. But if you don't realise that there's a sort of insidious, nasty atmosphere of fear, then you're actually in your own bubble, right? Because it's very unpleasant. John Mann said, final point, Lord Mann said the other day, and was backed up by other members of the House of Lords in a debate on anti-Semitism, which, by the way, hardly anyone came to. They took it so seriously. But anyway, that individual Jewish people are being targeted, discredited, losing their jobs. I mean, it's incredible. People who are on boards are suddenly being asked to step down, right? People don't know what's going on. This is like a really unprecedented in this country in recent years atmosphere, because they don't want to be guilt by association associated with someone who's Jewish, but they're not doing it because they're Jewish, but they're Jewish and they support the war that Israel is waging in Gaza in response to October the 7th.
Yeah, no, I think that really, really important points from Claire. I mean, it's interesting that in the past it would have been an article of faith that you would have stood up to anti-Semitism. You know, all the schooling that we've had about the Holocaust and the films and the books and everything and the narrative prior to October the 7th, anybody who saw themselves as progressive would have just, you know, would have been taken as given. And of course, that was never tested. That's the thing. You know, now it's being tested. October the 7th has forced people to look the whole thing in the eye and to look at what it means to defend yourself as a nation, and talking about Israel here. And it's forcing people to clarify, and it should be forcing people to have the discussions. So I think James Hartfield's article on your Substack is really important here, because he talks about specifically the Labour Party, but you could make the point more broadly about the fact that they are avoiding the discussion. They're just taking as a given that there's a threat from the Muslim community. It's just taken for granted. They haven't done anything for the Muslim community, so they keep throwing out this sort of FOP, which is, oh, look, we support Gaza, or some of them. And then they have this kind of watered down, or James calls it dumbed down, anti-capitalism, which, as we know, slips very easily into anti-Semitism. So nobody's prepared to have these discussions. And it's very, very dangerous time. I think, though, that we also have to, I don't want to say get the balance, because I don't want to belittle or reduce the threats and the problems that people are facing. But I do find that if we want to do something about this, it is quite difficult if everything we tweet and everything we write and everything we say is, look how terrible things are, look at all of the problems. Because who what are we proposing to do about it? Who are we appealing to? As people have said, it's ultimately you're hoping that the police will be more active, there'll be more bans, there'll be the marches will be shut down. If all we do is paint this picture of how terrible everything is. Now, I don't want to be sort of Pollyanna, but I think it's important to also then draw attention to when ordinary people do things. And I'm thinking here of the example we had this week of one of our friends, Kirk, who took the sticker off Amy Winehouse. And the reason I'm saying that is because it's not that we're trying to elevate that and say, wow, that's going to stop the next Holocaust or Kristallnacht or whatever, but it's to try and make sure ordinary people realize what is expected of them. So if you're on the tube and there are some people who've been on the Palestine demo, why not talk to them? Why not have a chat about, you know, why they support that? If you see a sticker or somebody ripping down a hostage poster, why not talk to them? Why not get involved? Now, that's what we're trying to do with our campaign. But what I'm getting at here is that we need to kind of create this atmosphere. We need to create this, send out this message for ordinary people that that's also what they should be doing if you're on the tube or on the or train or with people at work. And it's going to be tough, but there's no shortcuts. There's nothing else. So a quick plug for an event on Sunday. So a quick plug for an event this Sunday. That'll be the 25th. So if you're listening to this next week, you've missed it. But it will be at 3 o'clock in central London. The venue hasn't been released yet. And it's around the theme of No to Terror. So the 710 hostage campaign have been doing a lot of vigils and a lot of organized some of the demonstrations that you've heard about in London. They're organizing this one specifically to try and get across the point that Hamas is everybody's problem. And this is something that's, you know, the violence that I think Claire referred to earlier, 7/7, those kinds of incidents, London Bridge in the UK. This is something that affects all of us. And so on Sunday, there'll be an event in London. Hopefully you'll put a link to our website in the show notes. And so if you subscribe there, sign up, we'll notify people when we know about the location.
Brilliant. Thanks for that, Mark. Indeed, we will. Just before we go, I think it's important that we talk about what's happening in the Middle East, because there are obviously there is the question of Israel moving into Rafah. Here in the UK, that has been met by a lot of resistance. Obviously, politicians like David Lammy getting up in Parliament saying that this absolutely cannot be allowed to happen. But then the UK government sort of flirting with the idea of restricting arms exports if the Rafah invasion happens, US putting pressure on via the UN, and new ceasefire talks now being potentially happening in Paris. I think a lot of people, I think rightly so, are at least queasy about the fact that part of that area, which now is really full of very desperate people who have not got homes, living in desperate situations, potentially having to either move again or face quite a serious onslaught, is at least a tricky issue.
I just want to say that it would be ridiculous to be complacent about Israel's next military move. It's absolutely horrendous, the prospects of what might happen and the consequences for the people living in that area. One of the most irritating but also dangerous arguments is that those of us who support Israel's right to wage this war and to destroy Hamas as a necessary precondition for moving forward and for the hostages to be released and all of the things that go with it, but the destruction of Hamas, I want to emphasize, do not sit around, despite the caricature, you know, relishing the fact that so many people are likely to die in any such circumstances. I don't want to go into the fact that the Israeli Defense Forces say that they do everything they can to avoid civilian casualties. And I don't mean I doubt them. I just mean that the horrors of war are the horrors of war. And we're living this real time in terms of watching it. So it's a terrible situation to be in where this is the alternative. And I've got no idea, because I don't understand military strategy, whether there's any other alternative for Israel than taking this quite drastic move. But the hypocrisy of those people who suggest that either it's being done maliciously, willfully, because people, you know, Israel hates the people of Gaza, or to deny the absolute brazen way that Hamas uses its own civilians as human shields, is, you know, it's just naive in the extreme. But, you know, I would love this not to have to happen. But if Hamas laid down its arms, it wouldn't. Undoubtedly, if all the hostages were let go, it would give a pause. I mean, if anything would give Netanyahu a pause, that would be it. I've got no objection to people trying to come up with some diplomatic stuff behind the scenes. That's what you have to do in foreign policy, fair enough. But it's going to be savage. But the savagery was initiated by savage behaviour, willful savage behaviour of that pogrom on the 7th of October.
I agree with everything you say there, Claire. And I think this is a really good example of the virtue signalling that we were talking about in the previous segment on Parliament. So somebody mentioned, I think Ella mentioned, that Lammy is standing up and saying, you know, this must not happen. As if we can have any impact here, for a start, and as if we're military strategists, but it basically, they put their virtue, their sort of seen to be on the right side, above the practicalities and the perceptions that people have. So that the implication of them saying this must not happen is that Israel is not doing everything it can, which you alluded to there, Claire, doing everything it can to avoid civilian casualties. Now, you could, if you were a grown-up, having a grown-up discussion about a terrible war, you could say, well, maybe there's too many casualties. Maybe there should be more aid going in through a different route. Maybe Egypt should open, should take some people in. You know, you could have a grown-up discussion about how are you going to deal with Hamas. But that isn't what's happening. What people are quite happy to do is just simply, like I say, do their virtue signaling, do their kind of armchair strategists, do a bit of shrieking on the street. And unfortunately, nobody, we're back to the same point as before, nobody is really having the hard discussions. The international community, if they were serious about Hamas in the way that they were, say, about ISIS, then they would be more supportive. They would be looking at different ways of getting aid in. They wouldn't be sort of just using this, the US government, the way, you know, you look at Cameron, all these people just kind of pontificating on the situation. They would be looking at how they could practically help to solve the problem. So I do think that, you know, final point, I think that the there's a real risk here of increasing isolation for Israel. At the moment, you can see that just about the UK government is holding it, you know, that are supporting Israel, they're backing them, but now they're talking about a ceasefire, you know, and it is very worrying that as things become tougher and harder decisions need to be made, there are going to be fewer adults in the room, people start to worry about elections, and then Israel could be increasingly isolated. And so I do think it's on us to try and challenge that.
I think that's a very useful point. And it does strike me that the way that this situation is portrayed a lot is that a very gung-ho West in league with Israel is out to savage Hamas. And obviously, the situation that's been created means that, to my mind and to the mind of many others, that Hamas does need to be defeated. But it does also strike me that the idea that everyone's gung-ho about this is not quite the truth. And in many ways, Israel's relationship with the West has been, or the West's relationship with Israel has been one of showing support in the early days after something has happened, but fairly rapidly retreating from that support. And right from the outset, from October the 7th, there's been a sense that Israel, if it's going to do something, needs to do something very quickly before the support around it collapses, which to some extent you might say is motivating the push into southern Gaza because they want to deal with Hamas but feel that they won't have the support in the longer term to be able to do it. And I do think it does raise big questions about the future and what's going to happen in Israel and Gaza, because is it going to become some sort of protectorate or something like that? I mean, it does seem to me that the kind of way that it's heading means that the West has some sort of motive now to attempt to assert its authority over the region by some sort of solution that we'll see that will be imposed beyond the desires of the people that live there. And that to me is worrying.
Sorry, I as we come to the end of this, I just wanted to note that this is everything is an ongoing situation. But as we speak, Ross Grier, the Green MSP in Scotland, has organised a protest outside the Scottish Parliament to stop members of the arms industry going into Parliament for a meeting which they legitimately had booked. And I think this raises, and this is over Israel, and it indicates the dilemmas that people like us have, where this is not the right to protest, as he's asserting, but actually a blockade of people actually having the right to democratically meet and discuss in the Scottish Parliament. And I'm glad to see that some of the gender critical groups in Scotland that we've worked with as the Academy of Ideas are actually themselves opposing this and just saying, look, we support the right to protest, but this is them just trying to stop people they disagree with on the basis that this is all about stopping the civilian deaths in Gaza, right? And it's got nothing to do with that. It's corrupting our own politics. And at the same time, it's just been announced that Shemima Begum has had her citizenship rescinded, and people are saying this is an example of Islamophobia on the other side, and other people celebrating it. And I think it's more complicated than that. I think that she should be brought home, locked up, treated with the contempt she deserves, but we don't want the British state to have the right to strip people's citizenship. So I just think that this issue is going to throw up lots more interesting podcasts, sessions at the Battle of Ideas, discussions that we need to have, because God knows it's not straightforward.